anybody? I have no disclosures to, I have no relationships to disclose. I'm going to be talking about reframing emergency preparedness planning to incorporate climate change. I am really presenting work that our team has done. Elena Grossman is the Brace Illinois Project Coordinator. Ryan Cole is a recent graduate of our master's program. And this is work that Ryan has done, and I get to talk about all the good things he did. I'm going to talk a little bit about climate change, extreme events, and public health. Preparing for climate change. We know that there are two broad policy approaches to climate change response, adaptation and mitigation. The BRACE framework that CDC developed, the Building Resilience Against Climate Effects, is an adaptation approach. We're interested in building climate change into programs across health departments. So we don't expect a local health department to have a climate change staff person, especially a health department with a total staff of 7 or 12 people. But there will be emergency preparedness staff there, or people, even if that's one of the many hats they wear, they're doing preparedness. So we have been trying to build climate change into existing programs. We like Maria's idea, that's what we've been finding ways to do. Emergency preparedness, on one hand, is something that doesn't seem related to climate change, in that if there's a flood, if there's a heat wave, if there's a drought, if there's a vector-borne disease outbreak, the response is going to be the response, with or without climate change. But the preparedness planning part is something that needs to include data of future projections. So we were beginning at an even more elementary level: to what degrees are local health departments using currently available data, let alone projections for the future? I'll close by talking about briefly an administrative initiative that was a real major success story of our project. So as we know, and certainly the people of New Orleans know, there are very significant public health consequences of flooding among people who have been displaced, people who sustain economic housing damage. Mental health consequences are significant. Water damage, building materials can be great petri dishes for mold growth, and that can lead to many health concerns. Surface water quality is impaired. It can affect drinking water quality, especially in areas where there are poorly maintained wells or combined sewer overflow systems and inadequate local drinking water treatment processes, leading to outbreaks of gastrointestinal illness. Injuries are common, especially during the recovery phase of a flood. And carbon monoxide poisoning always follows flooding, in that people are using power washers and generators indoors, in basements, when they're supposed to be used outdoors, and carbon monoxide poisoning is always on the heels of serious flooding events. This photo is showing a slide of a town in Illinois in April of 2013, when there was widespread flooding throughout the state. Precipitation has increased, so climate change that has already occurred shows that, and again, this is from the National Climate Assessment that BJ mentioned, the Midwest and the East, you can see all of the areas where it's greener have become wetter, whereas areas in the Southwest that are brownish have become drier. So in the Midwest and the Northeast, it's gotten wetter. And not only has it gotten wetter, but rain is coming down in extreme events. So the percent of the year's rain that comes down in the top 1% of rain events is increasing. And in the Midwest, and again in the Northeast, heavy precipitation has become much more common. Illinois is not just the city of Chicago, Illinois is a pretty large state with a lot of river systems, the Mississippi, the Ohio, and a lot of rivers within Illinois put about 15% of the land area and an even larger percent of the population of Illinois in floodplains. Since 1957, there have been 39 federal flood declarations for flooding in Illinois. That doesn't mean 39 counties. Each flood declaration could include multiple counties. And it's been estimated by NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that about $5.5 billion of economic losses have occurred in Illinois over a 20-year period. So flooding causes health problems. Flooding has been, extreme precipitation has been increasing, and the future tells us that there will be more of that. So how to prepare? CDC funds health departments at state, local, territorial, tribal levels with public health emergency preparedness grants, the FEPS grants, and along with FEPS grants come guidelines on how to conduct emergency preparedness. And one of the steps is community preparedness, and a key element of preparing a community, and this is not specific to climate change or even natural hazards, but to begin with a determining health risks in your jurisdiction. And one of the ways that this is done is by conducting a hazard vulnerability assessment. And hazard vulnerability assessments can be done in all kinds of ways, but it seems that probably the most popular approach used by hospitals and health departments is the Kaiser Permanente spreadsheet, which breaks down predicting risk as the function of probability of an event occurring and the severity of an event if it were to occur, so that jurisdictions can evaluate what is our risk for flooding, what is our risk for chemical spills in our jurisdiction, for tornadoes, etc. And for each hazard, a probability is assessed, and then severity is estimated. And the two components of severity are magnitude, how big are the impacts of a flood going to be, and then mitigation, how prepared are we for that event. And you can see it's sort of these ordinal category, at ordinal levels of none, a little, a lot, a whole bunch. And based on that, a risk is calculated, and this allows entities that use this tool to identify and prioritize and address gaps. So our question, and really Ryan's question, was to what degree do climate data inform hazard vulnerability assessments? Because they certainly could in this forward-looking assessment. And even at a more basic level, how does self-assessed risk compare to objective indicators of flood risk in Illinois? Step one was to obtain hazard vulnerability assessments done by the 104 counties in Illinois. 97 counties completed hazard vulnerability assessments. They were not all done in that Kaiser format. The map on the left shows in darker green counties that did use an HVA approach, and other counties either in gray had no hazard assessment done, or they use some other approach, like an all-hazards mitigation plan, or in some cases just a list of here are our main concerns, without much in the way of methodology or data use. Entities that provided, that submitted hazard vulnerability assessments to the state health department were generally health departments, so that's again the dark green, but hospitals, emergency management agencies, planning agencies, and other entities were sort of the lead in developing a hazard vulnerability assessment for the county. Of the 94 counties that submitted, there were 77 that provided data in a form that allowed us to identify what are their top concerns, even if it wasn't using a Kaiser approach. And flooding was ranked in either the number one or the number two risk in the counties that are in blue. flooding was the second most commonly identified hazard of concern, second to tornadoes. And then we considered that to be the self-assessed risk, using some data, no data, just having the emergency manager, the public health administrator, the fire chief, and a few other people in a room, and just sort of by consensus sort of coming to some ranking of hazards or assessments of mitigation. We then compared that to some more objective measure of risk. So FEMA has a system called HAZUS-MH, which is based on a lot of data that utilizes data from a variety of sources to identify, in our case, population living in floodplains, past history of flooding and economic damage, and social vulnerability factors. This uses something that sounds very similar to the CDC ATSDR SVI, the Social Vulnerability Index. It's actually slightly different. It's the University of South Carolina, SOVI, the Social Vulnerability Index, which uses some of the same data layers. And based on this sort of more data-driven approach, we get a view of which counties sort of should be considered a high risk for flooding or a low risk for flooding. This is not showing all counties. This is showing just the 47 counties for which we had data in something like a Kaiser format. But comparing on the far left, what are the counties that ranked flooding as one of their two hazards, to using the HAZUS-MH approach, which of those 47 counties should be considered high, medium, low risk, and then on the far right, the number of federal declarations for flood disaster have occurred in individual counties, that's the far right. It's fair to say that these three maps don't look identical. And if you were to take the self-assessed risk and compare it to the HAZUS-based risk, we wanted to sort of identify counties that overestimate their risk and, more concerningly, underestimate their risk. The ones that are in blue are counties that actually seem to have a bigger flood risk than they think they do. This becomes an opportunity not only to educate local health departments about data resources, but at the same time to build in, you know, not only is all this data available that other people have compiled for your county, but here's data about what the future holds for flooding in Illinois. There are many limitations to what we tried to do. It would have been great if we did a study where we told health departments, here's how you should go ahead and assess flood risk, and then on the other hand, we had this well-validated measure that demonstrates actual flood vulnerability and risk, but that wasn't the case. We were working with data that was definitely not collected for research purposes. Most counties use different approaches. Some used the Kaiser approach, some filled it in differently. It was unclear how they went about assessing risk or probability or vulnerability impact. Sometimes the data were very incomplete. So there were quite a few counties that had impacts and mitigation, but no probability data, so we were unable to calculate their risk. We have had, I'd say, a couple of real, what we think of as nice success stories for the Brace Illinois project. We work with other departments within the State Health Department, and we have found a champion within the Office of Preparedness and Response. And because they are so committed to climate change adaptation, we've worked on two significant things. One is, and this is not because of the BRACE project, but the Health Department is moving away from this totally non-standardized, free-form approach of doing hazard vulnerability assessments to using a online systematic approach where counties and resource hospitals will go online and click in boxes, and everybody's using the same definitions of what category 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 means. Information is available about data sources. Information is available about what are the health consequences of flooding, of power failures, etc. It's not at the point, though, where it's data-driven that, in the sense that a county is linked to, let's say, the CDC Social Vulnerability Index of that county or the state climatologist data for that county. We would like to help get them there, but what we are primarily focused on is getting information from the National Climate Assessment built in so that counties can say, if you want to know what the expectations are for the future, here is that information. And the second really significant outcome is that grant language has been changed by the state. So the state makes funding available for local health departments and resource hospitals, and states have been entities have been asked to complete a hazard vulnerability assessment, and now they are told, when you are completing your hazard vulnerability assessment, include the possibility that extreme weather events may occur with more frequency or more severity. So a local health department staff member or an emergency manager has to now say something about the climate changing, extreme events becoming more frequent. So I'll stop there. This was funded by CDC, and I assume that they don't officially agree with anything I've said, but they might. And I'd be glad to take any questions. Yes. Yes.
One of the things that seems quite concerning to me is the fact that the middle map and the right-hand map.
Yeah.
So do you have any comment about that? Do you interact at all with FEMA to...
This isn't the only map we've made. We've taken the map on the far right, which is just about federal declarations of flood disaster, and overlaid it with the CDC federal... The CDC Social Vulnerability Index, and another layer, nursing home density per county, because here in New Orleans, it was, the nursing homes that couldn't evacuate that had a significant portion of the fatalities, and the nursing homes that did evacuate did well. So we definitely are coming up with our own approaches to assessing vulnerability. One of the real challenges, though, is that this hasn't really been validated. So if we're going to start adding data layers, do we weight nursing home density? Should that be like twice as important as poverty, or should it be the same weight? And how about hospitals within floodplains? How heavily should we weight that? So I think we and other BRACE grantees are sort of struggling with knowing how to make use of the data, because it certainly can be weighted in ways that give really different results, and how do we know which is the truth? Inputs are, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Well, it's basically you're making the same observation. If you have rivers there, you have apparently a lot of flooding events when you get heavy rain.
Yes.
Or something going on there.
Yeah, the Mississippi River is right here.
So vulnerability seems to be talking about primarily population vulnerability, but it's based in a paradigm of adaptation. So that's a historical reporting of where the disasters were declared. If anything in there assesses what has been done in the interim to
mitigate
or what have you, because a lot of the adaptation is not just due to the vulnerable population, but actually trying to hold the water back.
Right, the Army Corps of Engineers. And no, this data doesn't include that. It would be great to have that information. I don't know if you or anybody has suggestions about how to measure adaptation, or in the emergency preparedness world, that's called mitigation, but sort of hazard reduction. No, that would be great to have, but we don't have that. To some degree, one of the things that the Social Vulnerability Index from South Carolina, the one that was used for the middle map, does take into account is a lot of insurance data. So to some degree, insurance is all about risk history, but insurance companies are also thinking about risk in the future. So they may have better data than anybody. But we didn't use any engineering solutions or other types of adaptation.
Okay, why don't we open it up for, thank you so much. Why don't we open up for all of you? We have a great opportunity to end the session with some questions and discussion. I think all of our speakers touched on really critical parts of the climate change puzzle that is evolving right now as those of us in public health are trying to come to grips with how to do planning, how to do assessment, how to understand the risks, how to project the health impacts, and how to engage our communities and make sure that that community engagement includes disadvantaged communities of color and really engages those communities around health equity issues that climate change presents. So we have this opportunity to ask them some more questions or to make comments about what they've presented. Or you can ask each other questions. So, any questions? We haven't worked with schools, I don't know, honestly, if race projects in general are working with schools. I'm
school curriculums in California, and will they include climate change? I think schools are considered critical public assets in assessments of vulnerability, just like, you know, where are hospitals, where are schools, where are electricity generating stations. But I don't know, maybe somebody else knows specifically about.
So, well, one resource that we came about, I believe it was in Chicago, the Field Museum there. So they have a climate change program, and they're doing some, I'm not sure if it's curriculum development per se, but they are doing some programs with K-12 students and on different climate change themes, maybe art projects related to climate change, but they are building it in a little bit. We didn't see a lot of examples, but I think there are a few out there, but the Field Museum would be one to check out.
There actually is a national initiative to develop climate change curriculum for K-12, and I know the National Center for Science Education is involved, but as you can imagine, the Federal Department of Education would face a very uphill battle to get curriculum like that funded, so there's a lot of pushback on including, especially in public schools, including climate change curriculum. So, yes, in the back.
For those of you who are interested in climate communication, there's an excellent practitioner kind of learning collaborative and support group called Climate Access. Just Google them and you can join, and they have really excellent resources. They do webinars. They look at specific issues. They've had several webinars on public health and climate change and communicating around those. So they look at education and climate change. I think what you're hearing in some of the questions is the diversity of how public health people need to make connections with many other groups to move forward on our climate change work. I think Maria's study from University of Texas is an excellent look at how government and communities are or are not engaging around this issue and the role that public health professionals and public health departments and advocacy groups can actually play. What you're hearing from my experience being the lead climate and health planner in California, this is the cross-section of where we are right now. There's a number of things underway that we're still trying to formulate our understanding of the problem, really understanding the public health piece of that, and applying it to public health preparedness, data, and our community work in really dynamic ways right now. So let's see. We have a little bit more time if there's any other questions. Yes.
Even in rural counties, actually had emergency preparedness.
health agencies around the state don't have any climate programs. A couple of local health departments will dabble with, some climate initiative, but mainly it doesn't happen. A lot of our small health departments around the state, may have one environmental person that does vector and water testing and everything else, and that person also is a preparedness person. They're really, emergency preparedness is present in all health departments, or at least in all counties, even if it's through the sort of the FEMA Illinois Emergency Management Agency chain. So preparedness is there. Part of the reason we worked with preparedness is just because at the state level, we found people who really wanted to make it happen. Why flooding rather than another outcome? Flooding is common, flooding is widespread. The 1995 Chicago heat wave was Chicago, and when you're outside of Chicago, that's almost not really like our problem. That's Chicago's problem. So, and Illinois is a pretty agricultural state, so flooding and droughts are very important. And I don't really care if we're using the words climate change or extreme weather becoming more crazy and frequent and damaging every year. That's okay. If that's the language that the people in the agricultural community and the emergency management community are comfortable talking about, that's fine. But flooding is on everybody's radar, and it really is expensive. And because it's something that people are concerned about already, we worked on that rather than heat or vector-borne disease.
Yes.
Well, we do, yeah, I mean, so there are 14 cities and states that are race grantees of CDC, so we do have, regional and annual meetings of all of the race grantees. We sort of shared this as one of our success stories so that other states and cities can think about it. I'm not aware of other entities sort of going that route, but once that did happen, we realized, light bulb went off. Wait a second, states give out money in all kinds of ways to local health departments or counties. Are there other opportunities to plug in some requirement that, let's say, it's transportation or education or healthy eating, physical activity grants, to build in this idea that think about how, whether it's a benefits of climate change mitigation, or if it's some active transportation plan, think about how a changing climate impacts the work that you propose doing. So we haven't had any other grant language changes, but we're hoping to do that. Our governor just changed from Democrat to Republican, so that's going to have impacts at the health department. And it's unknown whether there will be the same zeal for climate change and changing grant language in the future. But we don't want to stop with preparedness planning.
I think that's a really important question because climate change fits in so many parts of public health, yet there's very little dedicated funding for climate change in public health. So I'm looking at Paul Schramm, who's from CDC, and I'm going to put him on the spot for a moment to maybe say a little bit about how the Center for Environmental Health, where the BRACE and Climate and Health Program is located in CDC, and the Public Health Preparedness Program, which is in another part of CDC, might talk to one another about these issues.
Some of which are
in California, we are talking directly with our public health preparedness program because, as Sam said, this money goes to virtually every health department in the country, gets a FEP grant, a public health preparedness grant. And climate change is certainly related to the work that they've done, as you also really well illustrated, how similar it is and how integrating climate change into those existing programs is probably the way to go. So I think we had somebody ask a question about occupational health. Where do workers fit into this picture? So we have lots of partnerships to be building as wherever you are in public health, you kind of try to take those next steps to look at how climate change affects your work. And the health equity and community participation vantage point also is spread very, very well throughout all our public health programs and is a driving force in many of them to address health equity. And so how we bring climate change into that is also another opportunity. So I want to thank our panel and all of you for being here this afternoon. I think the environmental health section, climate change sessions this year have been incredibly valuable and cutting edge and informative, and the audiences have been very engaged. So that stands us very well heading into Chicago next year to try to actually elevate this issue. There is a special topic committee on climate change in the environmental health section, and we're looking to actually expand, if APHA will go along with us, to expand that special topic committee actually as an APHA special topic committee on climate change and elevate this issue even more. So thank you so much. Well, we're just going to try to do that. I'm not committing, but it's an idea. So thank you all so much, and have safe trips home or to wherever you're going.